All right, we're ready for John chapter 18 in our study. Be turning there, and as we mentioned Wednesday night, this will be a repeat for those who are here. We're going to mention this each time until the new trimester begins in May. We have a second adult class. It meets in the classroom, large classroom in the back. And our numbers have dwindled in there for various reasons. It has nothing to do with the teaching or the quality of teaching going on. But several with children have come out of there so they can see to their children, etc. And so the men encouraged us to continue that class. And so we're giving that another shot for another trimester. Starting the 1st of May, Johnny Lockerbie will be teaching Acts back there. And on Wednesday, Drew Gibbs will be teaching the book of Joshua. And one of the things we're wanting to accomplish in that class, it gives men an opportunity to teach and develop. That's one of the things the men said to us as the elders met with all the men. And secondly, it gives the congregation a chance to hear some men that they would like to hear from in view of potential leaders in the future. And so if you would like to participate in that class, think about that. If you commit to go for a trimester and stay back there with them for a trimester before coming back out, if you will. So anyway, we'll mention that again. Here we are in John. This is our outline of John. We are starting the third and final section of the book as we get into what Baxter refers to here in his outline as the Paschal climax, the tragedy and triumph, his apprehension and his prosecution. In other words, his arrest and his trial. So we're going to get John's brief picture of the trial, and we'll see how that brief that is in our study today. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1 is, he is the true light. Chapter 2, his power and authority. Chapter 3, he is a teacher come from God. Very good. Chapter 4, carries this message to Galileans and the Samaritans. All right, Samaritans and Galileans. You had the right order, I didn't. Chapter 5, yeah, witnesses for Christ as he was called in question. Chapter 6, he is the bread of life. 7, controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. Very good. Chapter 8. All right. And so that dark nation needs to see this true light. Reminds me of the prophets. And you know why. Chapter 9. All right. Yes. The blind see and the seeing are blinded. Chapter 10. He is good shepherd. Chapter 11. He's the resurrection and the life. Now chapter 12 is his last trip to Jerusalem. That's an entry into Jerusalem for that final week, Passion Week, that we're going to put on a calendar here in just a moment. Chapter 13, that's where he begins this discussion with his disciples that goes through chapter 17. That's a unit of chapters. 14, he comforts the disciples who are discouraged. 15, yeah, their relationship to God, to Christ, to the world, to themselves. And then chapter 16, his final instruction. That's the last teaching he does for them. And then what does he do in 17? He prays. And now we're ready for chapter 18. Question number one, what's chapter 18 about? All right, yes, betrayed, arrested, and he is put on trial. To whom was Jesus taken? Question 2, when he was first arrested. To Annas, who's the high priest, former high priest, I might add. And we'll get to that here in a second. So here's what I call chapter 18. Jesus betrayed, arrested, and he was tried. And so Mark gives an abbreviated version of what we have in the synoptics. By synoptics, you know I mean Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because they're very similar. Verse 12 would summarize the chapter. The detachment of troops and the captain of the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and they bound him. And so he is bound, headed for trial. Three things happen in chapter 18. We have Jesus betrayed and arrested, verses 1 to 14. He's betrayed by Judas, and he is carried and he's bound and ready to be carried off for trial. So the second thing that happens in 15 to 27, we have him going before Annas, who is the former high priest. We'll talk about why did they take him to him then. And that was the Jewish trial. So this is John's summary of the Jewish trial. He really doesn't cover much about the real Jewish trial. And we'll talk about why I call it the real Jewish trial in a moment. And then 28 through 40, we have Jesus before Pilate. This is the Roman trial. And John does not give the full picture there. And there's an intent to. He's painting a picture that he needs to paint for his message. And he does that adequately in the story he tells. All right. Makes sense where we're headed? What we're covering, what we're not covering? Let's talk about his betrayal and his arrest. Let's start at verse 1. Verse 1 laces chapter 18 back into chapter 17. Remember at chapter 14, or chapter into chapter 15, Jesus said, "Let us rise and be going," and they must have stood up and then continued this discussion. And then there was the prayer of chapter 17. And then when Jesus had spoken these words, when he had finished saying the words of his prayer, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. That would be the Garden of Gethsemane. Verse 2 says that Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place. We'll come back to that in a moment. For Jesus and his disciples often went there. Now, I'm just tying verse 2 with the fact that Jesus departed out to the garden. This was a common place for Jesus to meet with his disciples and go with his disciples, spend time there, perhaps pray there. And so that's where he went, and the disciples go with him. All right, that's the setting. He's come from the upper room where he's been with the disciples in this setting of the unit of chapters 13 to 17. It all took place in that upper room on Thursday of Passion Week. And now we're getting into the late hours of the night, so we begin at verse 2. He's going to be arrested. So Judas brought officers to Jesus. Now notice at verse 2 that Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place. He knew the common place. Wood summarizes, supposes, and there is a great deal of supposition here, that Judas very well may have gone to the upper room, because Jesus would have spent some time there with the disciples. How many hours, how long that took, but I don't know. And that he may have gone there, seeing that he wasn't there, and the most natural place to look for Jesus is to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's something to think about. So at verse 2, this was a common place, according to verse 2, that Judas, having received a detachment of troops, we take that to be Roman soldiers. There is going to be a connection with some officers of the Jews in just a moment, working together, but they're under Roman rule and under Roman authority, and Roman soldiers are stationed in Jerusalem. Judas, having betrayed the chief priest and the Pharisees, that is basically the Sanhedrin, has already authorized, we're going to kill him, we got to go through all the legal stuff and make it look legal, we're going to go through the trial, but we're going to arrest him, we're going to kill him. That's what we're going to do. So they have commissioned Judas to be the man to betray him and paid him, as you already know. And so there is, I'm just trying to connect him, how he would have gotten the troops. The Sanhedrin could have very well authorized that you need to go with Judas. He's got a job to do, and you go in and y'all go get Jesus. I'm sorry? Yes. Huge number. Good point. This is not this detachment, or the King James, I believe, uses the word cohort, that it was a large number, and some have estimated perhaps even larger than that. Others have speculated, Woods does, that it probably didn't take the whole band, and so it may have been a smaller number, but I take it that it's at least the number that Tom is talking about here, a large number. So he comes out with a great number of soldiers, like they're looking for an army to fight, and they're looking for Jesus. More about that here in just a second. Good point, Tom. Look at verse 3. That he came with lanterns and torches and weapons. Large number of soldiers and officers, and they're bringing lanterns and torches and weapons, as if they're expecting to have to search for a man that's going to flee and that he's going to hide from them. And you think about that. They're expecting, and we're going to see that reaction, they're expecting to have to go seize him. He's going to run. He's going to flee. He's going to hide. We've got lanterns. We've got torches. We've got weapons. Put it in a modern setting. They've got the helicopter with the searchlight. We're going to have to find him. And he's just standing there and waiting, knowing what's about to happen. Verse 4. Jesus, knowing all things that would come to him. In other words, he knows what's about to happen. He knows he's going to be betrayed. He knows he's going on trial. He knows exactly who's going to try him, what they're going to say, what's going to be done. He's going to know they're going to crucify him. He knows everything because he is Son of God. He's deity. So him knowing all things that would come upon him, he went forward. Notice his boldness and said, "Who are you seeking?" Something John doesn't mention about Judas's action. Judas ran forth, kissed him. And the one that he would kiss would be the one that I'm identifying. So where does that come to play? Well, I don't know exactly. The kiss is not mentioned. Some speculate that it happened after Jesus asked, "Who are you seeking?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "I'm he." And then Judas runs forth. I don't know the timing of that, but somewhere in the middle of this, Judas runs forth and kisses him and betrays him with a kiss. This is the man that that is being identified. So who are you seeking? And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus boldly said, "I am he. I'm the man you're looking for." He doesn't run, doesn't flee, doesn't. Let's get ready to flag a phrase here at verse 5, and we'll make a point. And Judas, who betrayed him, also, here's the phrase, stood with them. He's not standing with Jesus. He's supposed to be a disciple of Jesus. He's not standing with the disciples. He's supposed to be a disciple. He's standing with the enemy. Judas stood with them. Might underline that. Get ready to make a note about that. Let's jump over to verse 18. There were soldiers and officers who stood by the fire warming themselves, and Peter, what do you see? Stood with them. He's not standing with Jesus. He's standing with them. Judas stood with the enemy. Peter stood with the enemy. There's a sermon in that, isn't it? Who do you stand with? Where are you standing? Whose side are you standing on? You say, I'm on the Lord's side, but where are you standing? Are you standing over there with the enemy? Are you standing with those that ridicule the Lord? Are you standing with those that fight against the Lord? Where are you standing? Peter stood with the enemies. Judas stood with the enemies. Where are you standing? That'd preach if we had time, wouldn't it? All right. Let's go further. Look at verse 6. Then when he said to them, "I am he," what happened to the disciple? I mean, to the cohort? They drew back and fell to the ground. They're shocked that this man who come forward, who are you looking for? Knowing that it's him they're looking for, that he boldly says, "I'm the one you're looking for. I am Jesus of Nazareth." That boldness took them back and they fell back to the ground. And so he asked them again, "Who are you seeking?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "I told you that I am he. Therefore, if you seek me, let these go their way." Now, that's not mentioned to my knowledge in the synoptics. What does that tell you? Let these go their way. Yeah. He's protecting. He cared for the disciples. He is interested in the welfare of the disciples. He's interested in the welfare of others. He's already told them they're going to face trial, and he's trying to avoid them being in the midst of this. Let them go. You're after me. You're going to kill me. I know what you're going to do with me. Let them go. And he's interested in their welfare. Now at verse 9, "And that the saying might be fulfilled which he spoke, of those whom you gave me I have lost none." Where was that spoken? Yeah, chapter 17, verse 12, when he was praying, he prayed that he'd lost none except the son of perdition, who was standing there. He's lost him. He's already gone. "That I might lose none of them." Let them go. Don't put them under the pressure. Don't put them under the trial. "And that saying might be fulfilled that I've lost none." All right, that gets us down through verse 9. So Judas brought the officers. Jesus asked who they sought, and then he identified himself. Now Peter seeks to defend this. So I want to look over to, get ready to turn over to Luke chapter 24 just for a moment. And we're going to flag some things and connect Luke 24 here. So now notice it beginning at verse 10, Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant's ear. Now we'll come back to that. But I want to drop over to Luke 24, beginning at verse 50. Luke 23, I'm sorry. And in verse 50. But anyway, the disciples, when they saw I've got the wrong chapter here. I'll get it in a second. I believe we're in chapter 22. I've got it. Chapter 22. When those around saw what was going on, reading at verse 49, they said to him, "Lord, shall we strike with swords?" Now, they had a sword with them, according to verse, they had two swords with them, in fact, at verse 38, where Jesus had asked him, "Do you have a sword?" And we have sufficient, we have two. But in Luke 22, when they saw this band of soldiers coming, "Shall we strike with a sword?" They'd already asked that question. Shall we do that? And Jesus' response to that was, he later says, no, that don't do that. But notice at verse 50 that one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear, not identified in Luke 22 or Matthew 26. John is the one that tells us that was Peter that drew his sword without waiting for an answer from the Lord and cut off the servant's right ear, and the servant's name was Malchus. Now, something John doesn't tell us that Luke does tell us. What happened? Jesus healed him. And touched his ear and healed the ear and made it whole. And so then Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword in the sheath, put it up." And what does he say to him now? What does that mean? Let's go back. Yes, very good. Look at verse 4. Him knowing all things that would come to pass. He knew what was taking place. He knew they were going to kill him. He had already told his disciples that he was going to die. We'll flag that a little bit later in the context. And be that as it may, he said, "Put your sword away. We can't stop this, and we're not going to stop this. I'm going to do the Father's will. I must go forward, and I must face this death." So let's get verse 12 now in that, and then we're going to come back and summarize what was missing from this from the standpoint of what's recorded elsewhere. At verse 12, then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews. Now here's the connection between the Roman officers and Jewish officers working together, because they have to be under the authority of the Romans, that they arrested Jesus and they bound him. He's not about to try to get away from them. He's boldly told them, "I am he," and he's going forward, but they bind him and carry him off as if he's a common criminal. Now let's stop there, and we'll get verse 13 and 14 in a second. What's not mentioned here that takes place in the Garden of Gethsemane. When Jesus went out to the Garden of Gethsemane, and in the midst of all that, John doesn't record this. The prayers, absolutely. Who said that? Stephen. The prayer that he offered, that Father, what did he say? "Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." How many times did he pray that same prayer? Three times. And that's not recorded in John. Matthew 26 records that for us. Let's get 13 and 14 here. He's taken to Annas. So verse 13, now we're going to get to the trial before Annas here in just a second. But verse 13 and 14, he said they carried him off to Annas in the late hours of the night. They led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. We'll say more about Caiaphas in just a moment when we get down to the end of verse 24. Now, it was Caiaphas who gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one should die for the people. Where was that said? Chapter 11 and verse 50. That was concerning the resurrection of Lazarus and the controversy over that. And so it was Caiaphas who was the high priest who had said, it's expedient that one die for all. That same man, that's who we're talking about. And his father-in-law had been high priest. He's not high priest now. So why do they carry him? Well, Annas had been deposed by the Romans when they came in power. And they had removed him and made his son-in-law Caiaphas the high priest. So officially, Caiaphas is the high priest, but many of the Jews recognize this is the real high priest. The Romans didn't have a right to take him away from us. So in their mind, this is the real high priest. He should be high priest, not his son-in-law. So they take him to Caiaphas to satisfy the trial, that aspect of the trial. But in order to accomplish this for the Romans, you got to go before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. And so that's why he goes before Annas first and then Caiaphas. All right, we're going to say more about Caiaphas at the end of verse 24 here in just a moment. So he's arrested, he's betrayed, and he's arrested, verses 1 to 14. Questions or comments? Yeah, here's a guy that will work with us. Yeah, they want a guy that will work with them. And so whether the Jews recognize it or not, that's part of the chain of authority. If you're going to get the Romans to execute him, he got to go before Caiaphas, whether you recognize him as your high priest or not. But they like Annas, and so they're going to go before him. All right, let's have him before Annas and the Jewish trial, verses 15 to 27. Now let's put some things in perspective here, things we've seen before. This will be the last time. I don't mean today's the last time, but when we get through with John, we're not going to see this calendar. We're not going to see the trials again till probably in detail till we come back through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John again. So we've been through Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We're about through with John. We're about through with the trials. But be that as it may, this is what we refer to as the last week of Christ, the Passion Week, and we're on Friday is where we are, in the early morning hours of Friday, late Thursday, early morning Friday, where he's arrested, he's tried, and he's going to be crucified. This is where we'll be this week and next week. And then in chapter 20 and 21, we're going to be on Sunday when he's raised from the dead. Make sense? Now let's talk about the trials. You've seen this before. I just want to refresh our memory of the trial. There were two major trials, the Jewish trial and the Roman trial, consisting of three hearings each. Not all Gospels mention all hearings, nor necessarily in sequence. And so you had the Jewish trial, they take him before Annas. John is the one that tells us about that. More about that in a moment. Then they came before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin before daylight, and then they have to go before the Sanhedrin again. So that was the third hearing. Now, John doesn't mention hearing 2 and 3 of the Jewish trial. He just mentions the first. All right? Then there's the Roman trial. They take him before Pilate, and then they came before Herod Antipas and come back before Pilate. So what does John mention? Well, John mentions hearing number 1 and hearing number 4 and hearing number 6. 1, 4, and 6. Make sense? He doesn't mention them all. Now you're going to see that right here. In the first hearing, they came before Annas, which would be about, some have estimated, midnight to 1 o'clock. And we'll come to those questions in a moment. And it's a very short, brief hearing. Doesn't accomplish much. What about your disciples? What about your doctrine? Well, I taught openly. The officer struck him. Why'd you do that? Why'd you strike me? And that's basically the trial. All right, he shifts him off to Caiaphas. Now, John doesn't mention this. So they take him off to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. We'll say more about him a little bit later. And then they have to have an official legal meeting after daylight. And so we come back to the Sanhedrin again. Make sense? That's the third hearing. All right. Then we move them to the Roman trial. Why do we have to have a Roman trial? Romans were ruling. The Jews are not allowed to execute without Romans' authority. So they've got to get the Romans to execute him. So they carry him to Pilate. Pilate doesn't know what to do with him. And so we have in the Roman trial, John mentions this fourth hearing. Does that make sense? So we're going to get that in just a moment. There's more to the story than what John records, but that's the fourth hearing. And then he sends him to Herod Antipas. John doesn't mention this. Only Luke talks about this. And then there is the sixth hearing, and John mentions this one. And he doesn't make a big distinction in them. But he goes before Pilate, Herod Antipas, Pilate again. That's the last, and then they crucify him. Making sense? I know that's the thumbnail description, but that's what we're talking about. Number one, number four, and number six. If you want to flag that in the margin of your text. Number one, number four, number six of the six hearings is what John mentions. All right, so let's talk about him being before Annas. Before we get him to Annas, we have the denial by Peter. So let's notice this denial by Peter. That Peter, Simon Peter, followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Who was that? Probably John. Do we know that? Not 100%. It's generally thought that John, writing the book, often referred to himself as the one that Jesus loved or the other disciple, rather than to refer to himself. So the argument that he's not mentioned is one of the stronger arguments that it probably was John. 100% knowledge of that? No. We don't know, but probably John. That disciple was known to the high priest. And so as they go to the high priest, to where Annas was, and Caiaphas, in the same region, that is the same building, that Jesus went into the courtyard of the high priest, but Peter stood at the door outside, but the other disciple, because he was known, went on in. Now what happens? Verse 16. He brings him into the courtyard. And then the servant girl who kept the door asked him, said to the man, said, you're one of the disciples. And he said, I am not. Denial number one. And the servants and the officers who made fire, but had the fire and the coals, for it was cold, they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with him and he warmed himself. Now we have him go before Annas. Now I'm going to skip that trial and jump over and let's connect 25 to 27. Now what happens? As Peter's warming himself, denies him again. Aren't you one of his disciples? He's denied, I am not. Or he's saying, I am not. And then one of the relatives of Malchus said, I saw you in the garden. And he denied again. And then what happens? Just as Jesus said. I want to go back to verse 16. John doesn't word it this way. But Matthew talks about Jesus followed at a distance. Verse 16 says, he stood outside. Here's a very practical thing. Distance is one of the first steps of departure. Let that sink in for a moment. Distance is one of the first steps of departure. Have you ever seen a disciple that was diligent and faithful and doing what they should, and then slowly they begin to distance themselves from the church? And distance themselves from association with Christians. I mean, just little by little, they keep getting further and further and further away, doing less, spending less time, less association. And that distance is the first step of departure. We're not surprised when they finally go astray. Peter's headed in the wrong direction here. He's following the Lord at a distance. Very practical thing to take heed to. All right. Now let's talk about him being before Annas. This is that first hearing. They rush him off to Annas. So verse 19, what does he ask him? About his teaching, his doctrine, and his disciples. What were his questions? I don't know. Perhaps it was, tell me what you've been teaching. There's controversy about you, and they brought you in here before me. So tell me about what you've been teaching that stirred all this controversy. Tell me about your disciples. How are you getting your disciples? How are you stirring up a following? How are you getting all that? And Jesus' response was, verse 20, yeah, I've been in the synagogues, in the temple, I've been teaching openly. So this was not done in a corner somewhere where you've got to kind of find out. I've said nothing in secret, so why are you asking me? What does he say at verse 21? Yeah, ask those who've heard it. Indeed, they know what I said. Let them tell you what I've been teaching. All right, verse 22. One of the officers stood by and slapped him. Notice your footnote in the New King James says literally, it means to slap with the palm or gave Jesus a slap or slapped with the palm of the hand. And so when Jesus said that, why ask me? Go ask the people that know me, that have heard me. And he slaps him across the face. So what was Jesus' response to that? Yeah. If I've done evil, tell me what evil I've done. Man deserves to know what the charge is against him. So if you slap me because, and I'm in here on trial, for evil, tell me what evil I've done. And if not, why did you strike me? Why'd you do that? Fair question, isn't it? Then Anna sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Wasn't much of a trial, was it? Tell me about your doctrine. Tell me about your disciples. And, well, ask other people. They know this is public knowledge. You ask yourself. And then you get slapped. And why'd you do that? If I've done evil, what was it? And if I haven't done evil, why'd you slap me? Well, then you need to go off to the real high priest, to Caiaphas. Now, one footnote about Caiaphas here. Stephen, can chime in when you want to here. Interrupt me if you need to. This is go to this, and then we'll come back to that. This is some evidence that was discovered in 1990 that Caiaphas is legitimate and real and true giving testimony this trial really took place. This is the Caiaphas ossuary that was discovered in November 1990 as they were doing some digging and some construction in the old city of Jerusalem. And they found in it bones of an old male, of a 60-year-old male, that was inscribed in Aramaic, Joseph, the son of Caiaphas, who's believed to be the high priest. And so this is what they found, and found within it. I won't take the time to read all of that. That is now located and display in Israel and Israel Museum in Jerusalem. But it had how many? Six individuals, including an adult male about 60, researchers of Tel Aviv University, other universities. I think it's authentic. It just gives some evidence that the Bible story indeed is true. Any comments you want to add, Stephen? Thanks, Stephen, for sharing that with us. Anyway, that gives us some evidence that Caiaphas is real. Caiaphas was real, and Caiaphas indeed is true. Now, let's see if we can squeeze in 28 to 40. This is Jesus before Pilate, and this is the Roman trial. So we have that number four listed as number one of the Roman trial. This is the fourth hearing. So let's see what happens here. We have the fourth hearing and then the sixth hearing. So this will wind us up. In the fourth hearing, verses 28 to 32, Pilate, as they come before Pilate, he said, what? Verse 29. What are you accusing him of? What's the accusation here? And this is always interesting to me. Verse 31. 30 and 31. If he wasn't... Can you imagine calling the police and saying, I want you to arrest this man? Okay, well, what's the charge? What's he done? Well, if he hadn't done wrong, I wouldn't have called you. So just go ahead and arrest him. That ain't going to go very far, is it? Carry it to the judge and say, Judge, put him in prison. Well, why? Well, I wouldn't have brought him to you if he hadn't done wrong, so just go ahead and put him in. That's the kind of trial going on here. And so he responded saying, 32, you take him and judge him based on your law. You're Jews. Y'all got a Jewish issue. Y'all take him, and no, that ain't going to work. Because the Romans have to execute, and we've already decided he's worthy of execution. All right, so let's begin at verse 33. Pilate then asked some more questions. And here are three questions that he asked. And so I've outlined this by question and not by all the details. The first question was, are you king of the Jews? Starting at verse 33. And his answer was, did you hear this yourself, or were you told this, or look at verse 34. In other words, there's king in two senses. The Romans, when they hear king, are thinking a threat to Caesar. The Jews know that. That's what they want the Romans to hear. He wasn't claiming that. There is the religious king in the sense that he is king of his kingdom. And that was no threat to Caesar. So are you king then? Well, he said, did you hear this? And so the next question was, well, am I a Jew? Your own nation brought you and delivered you here. And so he asked him, he said, what have you done? And he answered by saying, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were this world, then would my servants fight. Remember in the garden, they got ready, shall we take swords? And Jesus said, no, don't do that. And so I wouldn't be here if I had soldiers that were fighting for me. That's not the kind of kingdom I have. Jesus then talks about truth when he talks about this kingdom and truth. Notice he connects the kingdom and truth. So that I should be delivered from the Jews, now my kingdom is not from here. And he said, well, then are you king then? He said, I came for this purpose, verse 37, to bear witness to the truth. And everyone who hears is of truth hears my voice. And then Pilate raised the question, what is truth? Commentators are all over the place. Was that, some think that's a sincere question? I want to know what truth is. Tell me what truth is. I think it's in derision. Who knows what truth is? How do you figure out what truth is? This doesn't concern me. This thing of truth doesn't concern me. This is not my matter. I'm not interested. So what is truth? He didn't wait for the answer if he was really sincere. He walks out. And so he's gone. And he says, though, verse 38b, I don't find any fault. That's the verdict of this trial. I don't find any fault in him. In other words, I find nothing where I can put him to death. So he sends him off to Herod. That's not mentioned here. And then Herod sends him back. So let's pick up at verse 39. This is where that sixth hearing. So reading John and John alone, we don't have the picture of Herod. That's mentioned over in Luke. So here is the sixth and the final hearing. And all the details of this sixth hearing is not given here. So we have more information in Matthew. But basically two things happen in according to John's account. What happens here? Yeah, he says, there's a custom that you have for me to release one to you, to Passover. And so he thought maybe, let's release Jesus because I find no fault in him. And they said, not him, but Barabbas. Who is Barabbas? He's a robber and insurrectionist, not mentioned here, but in the parallel accounts. He's an insurrectionist, and consequently, they're accusing Jesus of leading an insurrection. But they want a man who was guilty of an insurrection. They want to let him go. So that's, we had the fourth hearing, and now we have this sixth hearing that we just looked at right here. This is what takes place in that sixth hearing. All right. We don't have time, but I'll leave that on the screen right there for some practical things. Number two. Is a good practical thing. If Peter could change and buckle, so could I. When I begin to think, I've got it. I'm on the right road. I'm going to stay on this right road. There's nothing's going to happen to me. Then I need to take heed to Peter, that Peter changed and he buckled under pressure. That could happen to me as well. Our time is gone.